Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet.
Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. It's Tuesday, July 30th, 2013, and I'm your host, Ariel Taylor, with my co-host, Lavendar. Anastasia won't be able to join us with the Starseed News this week, but she will be back next week. Our very special guests this week are UFO abduction investigators Kathleen Marden and Denise Stoner. Kathleen is MUFON's Director of Abduction Research and last year received the Researcher of the Year Award. Her interest in UFOs dates back to September 20th, 1961, when her aunt, Betty Hill, phoned her nearby home to report that she and Barney had encountered a flying saucer in the New Hampshire's White Mountains. Denise Stoner is Florida MUFON's Assistant Director of Abduction Studies and the head of the Florida Research Group, which is part of UFO Research of North America. Denise is a paranormal investigator certified in hypnotic regression, working with abductees, and she recorded evidence of the development of psychic abilities after their abductions. Together, Kathleen and Denise authored The Alien Abduction Files, the most startling cases of human-alien contact ever reported. Kathleen also co-authored a book with renowned UFO researcher and nuclear physicist Stanton Friedman called Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. Kathleen's website is KathleenMarden.com, and that's KathleenMarden.com. And Denise's website is DeniseMStoner.com. And that's DeniseMStoner.com. Well, we're still in the process of gathering the next soul group to go with us to Arkansas to dig for Atlantean crystals, experience crystal activations, and reconnect with soul family. The date is October 8th through the 14th, and if you have 25, 26, or 27 degrees of Taurus, Scorpio, Aquarius, Leo, Capricorn, or Cancer on your natal or progress chart, you have the rites of passage to participate. We have some spots still available, and you can learn more if you send an email to crystals@starseedhotline.com, and that's CRYSTALS. at starseedhotline.com. We'd like to thank Chris and Fiona for hosting our switchboard this evening, and you're welcome to call in with comments or questions. The number to dial is 917-889-8292. And remember to press 1 on your keypad so we know you want to come on the air. If you like our show, we'd appreciate your support by clicking follow on our show page. And if you're new to our show, our main site is starseedhotline.com, where you can find a lot of vital information for Starseed in our vault of knowledge. And the entire site has been coded for Starseed activations. We have a forum for Starseeds at starseedhotline.ning.com. And we'd like to thank Rose and Tammy for their great work and dedication on behalf of our Starseed forum. You can also find us on iTunes if you'd like to download our shows to go, or download them right from our show page archives. Now, I would like to let you know that if you want to contact us privately, the toll-free number for our website is 888-881-0881. The Stage 1 Starseed confirmations are based on Lavendar's discovery of star markings and your natal astrological chart. And the Stage 2 session is a one-on-one phone session available with Lavendar, Anastasia, or myself. Remote healing sessions for people and pets are also available with Tammy. If you have a birthday coming up, you should know when your 10 hours of power will occur by getting your solar return timing. Please allow at least 2 weeks ahead of time to make sure that you get it in time. And if you'd like a Stage 2 reading to interpret your solar return energies, beyond just knowing when the window is, make sure you book it 2 months before your birthday, as there is a waiting list. So now I would like to introduce my co-host for the evening, Lavendar.
Hello, so nice to be able to talk to everyone tonight about and talk to two ladies that I've read their book, The Alien Abduction Files, and I'm really anxious to talk to both of them because they have really gone the extra mile to do research and to write this book, and our audience is so awake and so ready to hear this information.
Well, they sure are. A couple of little news tidbits that I wanted to share before we bring Kathleen and Denise on. If you don't subscribe to ForbiddenKnowledgeTV.com, then you might not have heard about this, and that's how I found out about it, because I am a subscriber. But I got a link today to a video that you can find on YouTube. If you just put Cheerios commercial in the search box. Apparently, Cheerios has come out with a new commercial featuring a biracial family, and it stirred up a lot of controversy, and ridiculously so, because I thought we were past that. But in light of all of that, someone went to interview a bunch of children on their reaction to the controversy and to the commercial, and the gist of it is, wow, these kids are so awake, they are so conscious, they are so starseed, and the things that they had to say were so inspiring. I really encourage you to, not right now, of course, but after the show, go ahead and take a look on YouTube. Just put Cheerios commercial, and then as you go down the list, you'll see kids react to Cheerios commercial controversy. And I found it very uplifting. And the other little thing that Lavendar sent me was about a strange case where a man woke up with total amnesia, and where he used to speak English, now he can only speak Swedish. This came from the naturalnews.com. And this is a U.S. Navy vet in comparison to the movie The Bourne Identity. He wakes up with no memory but speaks perfect Swedish. And you might want to check that out in naturalnews.com. They have a lot of not-too-plausible explanations on what this is all about, but it sure does sound like a walk-in to us. So I just wanted to mention those few little tidbits here. And right now, I think we will get right to our special guests. Let me get your mics open, ladies, here just in a second. So I will introduce Kathleen Martin and Denise Stoner. Welcome to the show, ladies.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Thank you.
Well, you're quite welcome. So Lavendar is going to start us off here, and I know that she's got your book, so Lavendar, take it away.
Yes. Well, Kathleen and Denise, let me say that the people that are listening to this show are not skeptics. They're beyond believers because they are awake, and a lot of starseed and people that have had abduction experiences will be listening to this show tonight. So we really have a kind of a specialized audience that comes and listens to us every week. So I'd like to start by saying to you, Kathleen, can you give us a little overview of what to expect when we read or when the audience picks up the book, The Alien Abduction Files?
Yes, absolutely. The book will give you insight into what it is like to live life as an abduction experiencer. And you said that many people in the audience are, so they already know what their personal experiences are, but you will also read about several other people's experiences in living life, things that you can probably identify with yourself. Denise, had a highly significant abduction experience in 1982, missing time experience with her husband, her 14-year-old daughter, the family dog. There were members on the other end, family members waiting for them. They did not arrive until 4 hours beyond the time that they were supposed to arrive. Very startling experience. And then she had another one in 1991. She's lived her life as an abduction experiencer and has a great deal of insight, knowledge, and messages from the ETs. Then Jenny Henderson is a lifelong experiencer as well. She has multi-generational abductions in her family. Credible woman, comes from a good family, prominent family in the state of New Hampshire. She had one close encounter and missing time experience as a teenager. Her abductions probably started years before that because she recalls experiences throughout her life. Didn't really understand what it was all about when she was younger, but she finally put it all together. And she, too, has received messages from the ETs. Her children have been taken. And now her grandchildren, and she has a lot of insight into all of this. And then there's a third section in the book of a number of experiencers, some one you might have heard of, others you have not heard of. And they have all had abductions and are credible people, and I have investigated their cases as well, but not for as long a period of time as I have in the case of Denise and Jenny Henderson.
Let me ask you a question. Do you find that a lot of young children are taken at the age of five? Does the age of five show up for you a lot?
Well, you know, I can tell you, Denise and I actually did a commonality study in the year 2012. We had 50 experiencers that participated in a 25-person control group. And one of the questions we asked is at what age they were taken. And 36% said that they were under 5 years old when they were taken for the first time. 20%, 5 to 10. 8%, 10 to 15. 64% said that they were under age 15 when they were taken.
Wow. Okay, that kind of goes along with some of the things that I've been tracking. So let me go to you now, Denise.
Yes.
I was so really riveted by your story as I was reading it. Give us a little insight to what's happened with you by telling this story and how you decided to come out and tell it now.
Well, first of all, my age. I've retired. My husband's retired. The majority of my family, including 12 cousins, they're all past retirement age, and they're in a position where most people would not figure out who they were. And so in talking to them and speaking to my family, and my mom's going to be 85 in December, she has absolutely no qualms about me doing this, and I felt like I've always wanted to help other people, to give insight into what has happened to me and what I live with. And now is the time, because if I grew older, if something happened to my memory, if I wasn't able to do this and speak out about it when I turned 70 or 80, what would happen? I would have lost everything I've always wanted to do for others. And so this is it. It was time.
Take us on a little journey about you driving in the car. Just go ahead and tell us in the audience about what happened to you on the road on your way to your, I guess it was a family picnic.
Well, it was actually a family camp that we had put little mobile homes up and had been doing it for years. And we had packed our car by 5 p.m. in Denver area. It was actually Arvada. And my parents lived in Colorado Springs, so they had a quicker trip. They were going to go up and set up. and my mom was going to cook dinner for us. They came another route. It only took them approximately 2 hours and 15 minutes, and it took us a little longer, over 3 hours. So we left, and we wanted to get to an area outside Denver called Kenosha Pass. It overlooked a valley. It was a glacier valley called South Park Valley. And at the base of Kenosha Pass was a little town called Jefferson. And we always got out of the car for about 5 minutes, stretched our legs, got back in, and then completed the trip. Crossed the valley, took about an hour and a half to get across that. And my husband had set our odometer or trip meter because it was a pretty new car, and he was concerned that we weren't getting the gas mileage that we should. So he set the trip meter, and we got out at Kenosha Pass, looked down in sunlight across the valley, and of course in Colorado you can see all the way across. We could see the next set of mountains on the other side. We dropped down into Jefferson, and when we got to that little town and drove through it, it's just very tiny, 4 miles outside of Jefferson, and my husband and I were just talking the whole way, all kinds of subjects. And we drove through about 4 miles outside. I had been watching and observing this set of lights way out in the high desert. There was nothing else there. There's no tall trees, nothing. And they were traveling towards us. And they came closer and closer and closer until finally they were over the top of the car. And I had thought, oh, some sort of anomaly, something just going on with a reflection or something. I just wasn't really concerned until they reached the top of the vehicle. And I turned to my husband to say, what are those? And he was frozen to the wheel. His eyes were staring straight ahead. He wasn't responding. He wasn't moving. And I looked up above and I saw the huge lights, and they were so bright, but yet they weren't shining into the car. And I knew something wasn't right. Something was wrong. And on either side of the road, we had huge snow barriers. So in the dark, in the winter, the snow or big, tall tumbleweeds wouldn't cross the road and cause a wreck. When the cars would hit them or the snow blowing across wouldn't cause trouble to the vehicles. So I looked at those, looked at my husband again, and fear is setting in. And then the tires on the driver's side of the car started to scrape in the road, and I realized the car was moving sideways. And at that point, before I could do anything else about it, the car lifted off the road, over the snow barriers, and into the high desert. And it was pretty rapid. It was moving pretty, not very high, just enough off the desert to keep moving and moving until I realized it was going to settle down. And then when it came to a stop, and the car was coming down, going to hit the desert sand, all of a sudden everything went dark, or my memory was gone, and the next thing I knew, we were all the way across that desert valley, and we were on top of an area called Trout Creek Pass. It was pitch dark. The sun should still have been out. It should have been about 10 minutes to 8 in the evening. It was summertime. It was 11 o'clock at night. My husband was still grasping the wheel, but he looked frightened. He was shivering because the nighttime desert air is cold. My daughter was sound asleep, or our daughter, in the back of the car. I was panicking. I was then in full-blown panic. I didn't know what had happened. The headlights were on, and we didn't turn them on. The odometer, which was checked immediately, had not changed. It had not moved. And we said, okay, let's pull over. My husband said, we need to pull over and think for a minute. So he did. And we started to ask each other questions. What did we remember? What happened? Nothing. A blank. So he said, okay, your mom's waiting for us. This is going to be, you know, frightening for them if we don't get going. We had another 7 to 9 miles to go. So we did. We drove on. We went into a little town called Buena Vista. Another few miles outside of that, we turned into the ranch property where we encountered my dad, my mom, my family friend walking down the dirt road towards the caretaker's house at the ranch. and they were going to knock on the door and ask to use the phone because there were no cell phones back then. And then they were going to call hospitals and firehouses and police and ask if we were in, you know, picked up anywhere, something had gone wrong. And barring that turning out negative, my dad and his friend, longtime family friend, were going to get in their vehicles and start driving our route to see if they could find us off the side of the road. So we rolled down the window as we pulled in, and my dad said, what's going on? You know, what's happened to you? And our answer was, we don't know. We don't know, Dad. We just have no answer. And my mom had to have an answer. She was a mom, and she wanted to know right now what had happened, and I couldn't tell her. My dad was kind of a quiet, unassuming type, worked in aerospace, and he knew sometimes there couldn't be answers, so he didn't press. Same with our friend. My mom kept it up pretty much all weekend. Come on, what's the secret? What's going on? And we kept trying to come up with answers, and there just weren't any.
Wow. So how long did it take for your mom to understand what really happened?
It was quite a long time. She did stop asking after a while, and I was having kind of flashbacks of big faces, great big eyes, these things looming over me, metal tables, some procedures being done that were painful, things like that that had gone on, but nothing hooked together, nothing connected that I could put something together in the way of framework for it. So I had nothing to tell at that time.
Right. So how many years was it before you discovered what actually happened?
It wasn't that many because I had a friend. His name was Dr. Romack, and I called him. He had been working with me on some other types of hypnosis to control pain instead of using medication. He'd taken me on as kind of a guinea pig for that. I had volunteered, and we found out we had a mutual interest in things, UFO and so forth and so on. And I called him and I said, well, it looks like you might have a guinea pig to work with here also, and I need help. So I went in and we began this whole process. Everything was taped and recorded, and he took notes, and it went on I worked with him for 5 years. The problem was when we moved to Florida, Dr. Bob passed away, had a massive heart attack on his living room floor, and all of the tapes were lost. Everything was gone. And his wife, his children that passed away before him, I was not able to retrieve any of that information. And slowly, wondering if something was wrong with me and with what we had done as far as getting a hold of these items, I started to forget. And
I'm always about backup. I'm always, okay, well, back that up, give that copy to someone. We don't want to lose this story. You know, I'm like that. Sure wish you could have thought of that yourself.
I know, and I just didn't. It's one of those things where you think, oh, we're going to work together for a lot of years to come, and we're going to this, and we're going to that, and it just happened that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very sad, and I was very close to him, a very good friend, and didn't expect him. We communicated for a long time after I moved to Florida. I didn't lose touch with him until his wife communicated that she'd come home from the store, and there he was.
Oh, goodness, so sorry. Tell us a little bit about what you know now about some of the things that happened to you aboard ship, some of the things that would be, you know, very interesting to our listeners.
Well, I know that I was taken from a very young child. I wasn't sure what it was until I grew up and found out that those little visitors weren't imaginary nursery rhyme characters, because when you're young, how can you possibly say that those are aliens? You can't. So I found that out when I got older, and we put those pieces together. I found out I was used as a breeder. I found out I had been given some messages that I can't pull them all up because something happens, and we want to keep that as a marker for ourselves to work with others right now. We're trying to find out how many others might have the same thing happen to them when they try to recall what this message is, because there's an actual reaction to trying to force the memory forward. I've been told something. I've been taken to the center core of a craft, and I've had physical reaction that is now on video that Kathy's going to use for her lectures, and I will also, because people need to see this. I'd like to know if anybody else has had anything similar happen. I wasn't aware of it the first time until Kathy asked me if I remembered what happened and what I felt like, and I said no. And so later, a few weeks down the road, I asked if we could do it again and videotape it, and she did, and I saw for myself, and I said, well, I'm feeling some of that during the day, and I'm trying to have it diagnosed, and the doctors can't give it a diagnosis.
Wow. That's pretty incredible. Did you see different races, or were they all the same? Did they look all the same?
I saw the tall gray and the small grays that I call the soldiers, and I saw an insectoid that is, I call him the doctor. And only one other time did I see something that might have been maybe a hybrid type, that he's the one that gave me the message that I have. And like I said, only once. And I felt that he was a very, very much higher being, and perhaps some sort of teacher.
You said that you discovered that you were a breeder, so that means that they came and got your eggs and grew the hybrids aboard ship, or did you actually get impregnated and grow the baby up to 3 months and then they would come and take it? Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, they came and took it.
Yeah. How many do you think happened this way?
Well, I'm aware of, I believe, three, but I had one miscarriage that was very frightening because I don't think it was supposed to happen, and I miscarried in the mountains in an outhouse. And I was so terrified at what I saw. I drew it for Kathy, and she has it locked up in her home, that I would even be afraid to show it to anyone. And I was taken that day when I got to the top of the mountain where we were going to have a picnic, found my husband, my daughter, and a relative just standing stock still at the picnic table, not reacting. I was taken and told that they had to take me for a very brief time, and they had to fix what had happened.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. You have a lot of courage just to be able to, you know, be able to talk about it and to maintain your sanity through all this. And those that are listening that have had abduction experiences would really be enhanced by getting this book called The Alien Abduction Files. So I noticed that throughout this entire book that you were able to really hold together your presence of mind through all of this, and how commendable I must say to you for being like this, because in those years, this was not accepted. I mean, you went through the tough time of people being skeptical, and you just probably you couldn't talk about it. You know, we can talk about it now. It's out in the open, and there's movies about it, there's books about it, and it's more common. But you went through what we call the dark ages of alien abduction.
That's true. But if it weren't for Dr. Romack and then for Kathleen to help me work this out and to go through the last 3.5 years in writing this, and then supporting me, because she did witness some very sensitive times when we were working with the hypnosis and bringing this back, and being quite capable of being a mentor and supporting me, I don't think it would have worked like it did.
Okay, I'd like to leave you just for a minute, Denise, and go to Kathleen. Kathleen, what are the similarities and the differences between today's abductions and those that occurred during the early days of the alien abductions, such as your aunt and uncle Betty and Barney Hill's abduction in 1961?
When we think about the abductions that occurred back then, there was generally quite a lot of evidence that something had occurred. You would have normally people driving down a desolate road, such as with Betty and Barney, with Travis Walton, with three women from Kentucky, from many, many more, or outside fishing, such as Charlie Hickson and Calvin Parker in Pascagoula, Mississippi. And a UFO would come down. They would watch it for a while. They would see it, and there were often witnesses who also saw it. And then the UFO would abduct the individuals. A lot of times it would land, and it would walk them or carry them onto the craft and take them on board. They would do similar physical examinations to what is done today. It was probably the very beginning of the hybridization process. Back then, they did take ova from my Aunt Betty, and they did take sperm from my Uncle Barney. And it makes me wonder if I have cousins out there somewhere that I haven't met before, or if I have met them, I don't remember them. So it was different in that there was so much evidence, and they were not generally taking people from their bedrooms when they were asleep back then. But somehow all the programs seem to have changed along the way, and I suspect that the ETs developed a new modus operandi because they traumatized these early people, such as my aunt and uncle. And they had a lot of conscious recall of what had occurred, and it was very troubling, and it caused problems in their lives, and they ended up Betty and Barney ended up seeing Dr. Benjamin Simon, who was a prominent psychiatrist in Boston, Massachusetts, because my uncle had developed post-traumatic stress disorder. That's what we call it today, anyway, and saw him for a period of 6 months where he did regressive hypnosis separately with them, imposing amnesia at the end of each session. And this is something that I ended up doing with Denise Stoner and with her husband as well, following Dr. Simon's model in doing that part of it. But moving on to abductions today, somewhere along the line, and I think it was probably in the mid to late 1970s, the ETs started to take people from their homes. And they would do it at night. Sometimes people are sleeping, and sometimes they're wide awake. This causes a problem for people today because about three-quarters of those who participated in our commonality study stated that they have difficulties falling asleep and remaining asleep at night due to fear of abduction. So this is a big problem. We didn't have that problem when people were taken off the highway the way they were back in 1961 and in the 60s and early 70s. Also, today we know that we have the hybridization program. So the individuals are seeing and holding their hybrid children on the craft. And some individuals are talking today about having been impregnated by the ETs and possibly giving birth to late-stage hybrids. And Jenny Henderson is one of those that I wrote about in the book, who was impregnated by the ETs, and that they were checking up on her, and that she might have a child who is a hybrid. We also know that today the possibly this process of moving individuals through solid surfaces such as walls or windows or ceilings might have an impact on the abductees physically, and that perhaps this is what is causing such a high rate of chronic fatigue and immune dysfunction syndrome and fibromyalgia among today's experiencers. I am not aware that this was occurring back in the 60s or 70s with the early experiencers, but it is occurring today with people who are being taken through solid surfaces. I don't know if it's the alien environment or if it's that abduction process, but there's something going on there, and Denise and I are working on this to try to find more answers about what this is. But today, so many people tell me that the ETs seem to be tweaking them. They seem to be interested in maintaining their health, and their health will begin to fail. They'll be taken on board the craft, and they'll undergo procedures that seem to be intended to improve their health condition. So at least the ETs are working to help their human subjects to keep us in very good condition.
You know, I've had a lot of clients to tell me that they have fibromyalgia and some of the symptoms that you're talking about, and that makes a lot of sense because, you know, when you think about going through walls, it's got to change you a little bit.
Absolutely. You know, to change the atomic structure of your body, to pass you through a solid structure has to do something. And
yeah,
many of those I have to tell you, many of those early experiencers also didn't report having the kind of paranormal activity and psychic abilities that they have today. And those are very similar to what we hear about near-death experiencers. So I'm wondering if abductees actually undergo a near-death experience in this process of being moved. And perhaps that is why they're developing these psychic abilities and having this paranormal activity in their homes today. I think that somehow this might all be tied together.
I think you're right, because of the experiences that I've had and what other people have told me. I think that there's a nanosecond in between, you know, the life and death breath that they tap into in order to change the frequency to take everyone aboard ship. So I think you're right about that.
Yes, and you know, I've spoken to three physicists about this, theoretical physicists, and they have told me that, of course, everything you mentioned, frequency, everything has its own vibrational frequency. Our human body has a higher frequency than a solid structure, for example. Nothing is completely solid. Everything is in motion. And they say that it's perfectly reasonable that if they have the technology to match up frequency and phase of the human body and the solid object, this is theoretically possible, because 99% of the atom is empty space between the proton and the electron. So it is theoretically possible, and it has even been done on a very small scale in a laboratory.
Have you been abducted at all through all these years? Have you been taken aboard ship?
Have I? I have memories of it. I don't have evidence. I don't have physical evidence like the early ones, but I do have some memories. I don't know if they're real or if they're dreams or what, but, boy, I have some memories.
Well, you know, it sounds like that you probably have been, yes, part of this story and the teams of things that have been happening to so many on the planet. And do you have any idea how many abductees are actually been taken? Has anyone ever given you a figure of what they think?
Well, the only thing that I can quote from is the Roper poll that was done by Bud Hopkins, and I think David Jacobs was involved in this, and Professor Don Dondery from McGill University helped them with this. And they came up with a figure of 3.7 million Americans. But that was not the team who came up with that figure. It was the Roper poll people who did this statistically. And they had a problem with a couple of the questions. One of them was, have you woken up paralyzed with a sense of a strange presence in your room? And, of course, we know now that that happens with sleep paralysis as well. So you can't say that all of those people who answered yes to that have been abducted. Did you have missing time and a feeling of sensation, seeing balls of light in the room, that sort of thing? So, well, yeah, that's pretty common with experiencers. And, you know, you might have a sensation of flying in a dream. Anyone might have that. But seeing balls of light is something that's pretty much something that happens with experiencers. Do you find puzzling scars? Well, that was a question that we asked on our commonality study, and some of a small percentage of the control group found puzzling scars on their bodies, too, and scratches and that sort of thing, but they were different from what the experiencers found. You know, so Bud Hopkins ended up thinking that it was probably closer to 560,000 adult Americans who might be abductees, not 3.7 million. But still, that's a pretty large figure when you think about it.
You know, I have a feeling it's a lot more than that, just from my feeling about things. Have you ever heard about ships that come in unison and take a whole town and beam them up, and then beam them all right back to their beds? Have you heard about that?
Well, not a whole town, but I can tell you that I've heard about all the people in a hotel, for example, and even in the book, I wrote about a large-scale abduction in which Denise and Jenny Henderson were probably aboard the same craft with many, many other people who were all taken on that particular night at that same time.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been tracking things like that, you know, mass abductions at once. That's been something that I've been kind of looking at for several years. Denise, I'd like to go to you now and ask you, what are the signs and the markers that indicate that you should proceed with an investigation when they come to you? What are the markers?
Well, there are many, and to start out with, Kathy and I have both set some aside that we do not mention, just as if we were working a crime scene, because if we let those out, they're very special, and people might decide that they have those markers. So, having said that, we like to tell people that they may wake up in the morning with some unusual bruises, but they're exceptionally unusual. They may wake up and find that on their upper thighs, their calves, upper arms, long, skinny, finger-like, and there are usually three of them, bruises. That's one thing. If they have unusual nosebleeds, when they don't have a tendency to do that, they may have some unusual marks that look like puncture wounds, perfectly round puncture wounds, and then sometimes there are three of those in the shape of a triangle. Nosebleeds, like I said that, they may wake up in another room in their home and they don't have a tendency to sleepwalk. They may also find that they have on an item of clothing that doesn't belong to them. They may have their night clothes on backwards, and they know they didn't do that in their sleep either. So there are several things that we look for, and we ask people to, unusual dreams of entities. and also then their neighbors or themselves might have a sighting of a craft. So that would give people some ideas of what we're looking for. And one of the main ones is we normally don't have people seeing entities walking around without having witnessed a craft. The day before, the night of, or the day after, there's usually a sighting to go with it.
Let me ask you, because I've had this happen several times in talking with people, especially my dear friend Richard. He was taken and put in a tree. He woke up and he was in a tree.
Oh my!
And didn't know how he got there, and that kept happening. You know, they'd take him and they would plant him in a tree instead of bringing him back to his bed. So did you ever run into that?
I have not. Okay. Was he pretty well bruised up, or was it, what type of tree was he? That's interesting.
You know, I don't really remember what he said about it, but I know that it happened several times, and it was hard to explain to his family. This was when he was really young.
Oh, when he was a child. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
No, in his pajamas in a tree.
Wow. Oh,
yeah.
My.
I know.
Yes, I have never heard of a person waking up in a tree, but Stan Romanek says that he woke up on his roof one time and with no ladder to get down either. And I've heard of people who wake up in the wrong house, or
yes,
you go to bed in their own bed and wake up in a hotel room.
Yeah. Yeah, well, sometimes the ETs aren't too swift about
That's true.
Yeah. I've had several people tell me that they wake up in very strange places.
That's true.
So,
yes.
Let me ask you, Kathy. You write about an investigation that you had in New Hampshire. Can you tell us more about Jenny Henderson and her children and her experience in '88?
Yes. Jenny was a high school teacher in New Hampshire, married to a businessman, and had two children, a son and a daughter. And it was a typical Saturday night. It was a long weekend. They were looking forward to a typical Saturday night of a movie at home and having pizza and spending time together as a family. And then they went to bed, and during the night, a sound woke the family up. The dog, they had a boxer named Ruby, and the Ruby was barking and barking, and then as if in mid-dog sentence, it was simply cut off. And, you know, she was really wound up, and suddenly it ended. And then Jenny sensed someone entering her bedroom, sort of a rush into her bedroom, and at first thought that it was her young daughter coming in during the night. Maybe the dog had woken her up. But then Jenny's husband sprung up out of bed and was very swiftly put back down. And then she saw these glistening eyes, and she realized that it was the ETs coming for her again. And she thought that this was over. It hadn't occurred in a few years, as far as she could remember. And she tried to escape. She tried to stop them from doing what they were doing. But they did very rapidly take her from her bed up through the window. She had a very large bedroom window. And when she arrived on the craft, she found that they had also taken her children and had taken them to separate rooms and for examinations and some tweaking for Jenny. And there was an accident that night, apparently, and Jenny woke up in the morning with burns on her back, two triangular burn marks on her shoulders, and then more like a sunburn on her back. When the tears ran down her cheeks, it formed red trails, and something had happened to her hair, and it was no longer silky. It seemed burned and straw-like. She ended up setting off electrical appliances around her home. Every light that she turned on blew out in succession. Every appliance she picked up blew out in succession. She walked by her son's computerized handheld game, and it turned on and started playing by itself. That had never happened before. She saw blood on her pillow. Her young son, who was about 10 years old at the time, came out and from his bedroom and said, "Mom, you know how I never believed that UFOs were real?" And she said, "Yes." And he said, "Now I know they are." And she asked how he knew that. And he just said, "You know what I mean," and turned around and walked back to his room. And she followed him in, and there was blood on his pillow. And then she went upstairs to her daughter's bedroom, and her daughter reported that she had observed a craft outside her bedroom window the night before, and that she was younger. She thought it was an airplane or a helicopter or something, but it was very close. She said she could see people inside it, and she'd almost woken her mother up but didn't want to disturb her. Both children said that they felt as if they were completely worn out that day. They couldn't get up and go to church that morning. They wanted to sleep in. And there was blood also on her daughter's pillow. It had a huge impact on the family, on the children, who became terrified as these abductions occurred throughout their lives. They ended up sleeping with knives under their mattresses. Jenny found the knives as she was making their beds. So it was not a good experience for the family. But over the years, we've worked together, and Jenny has come to learn more about all of this. And education really helps. And she and her children have been able to overcome their fear and look at this more academically, in a sense, to discuss more of what is going on and what the alien agenda might be. So they've made a lot of progress and are better able to accept this than they were earlier on.
So do you still talk to her now? And how about her children? Are they okay? Are they mentally stable now, or do they still have problems?
The children are grown, very successful. They're both in business. They're mentally stable. They have children of their own, leading just normal lives. You would never know that they had these experiences as they were children. I think that one of them is probably still being taken as an adult occasionally, but the other one doesn't think that he is.
So in my experience, I find that there's two groups of abductees. There's ones that raise their hand up before they came to the planet and said, "Yes, if you need me, you can take me." And then there's the other group that says, "You know, I don't have any memory of making a contract with anyone to come and take me in the middle of the night." Are you finding that too?
Yes. You know, some people, and Barbara Lamb started publicizing this, and there are others who have, too, that people are told that they did have this contract before they were born. But in the case of Jenny Henderson, she has no memory, certainly, of ever making this contract. And I don't know about Denise. I've never asked her that question.
You know, I don't know. All I can say is that I've had several pretty close calls health-wise through my life. I have a strange blood disorder that can't be really diagnosed. They think it's genetic, but they can't name it. And I had one really close call, a near-death experience. And when I had that, I had something in my head when I came out of it that had to do with a contract. And so that would be something to do, perhaps under hypnosis, to find out if the contract has something to do with abductions. I don't know, maybe, unless I'm asked. But I've had that in my head for a long time.
Yeah, okay. Wow. Kathy, I'd like to ask you about, you have written two other books with Stan Friedman, and now you've written this one with Denise Stoner. And why did you choose to work with a co-author?
Well, I'm a social person, and the writing process can be very lonely, sitting in your office day after day, writing alone. I like to bounce ideas off from other people. I just enjoy the friendship and working together. I've always worked as part of a team throughout my adult career. I started out as a social worker, and then I was a teacher and an education services coordinator. So it just comes naturally to me to work with other people. And so that's why I do it.
Okay, that's great. So Denise, in the long and the short of it, what do you think the agenda is, or what you have discovered about all the people that have been taken aboard ship and been tested or rearranged or become breeders? What is your final analysis of what it is that they're conducting or helping us with here on the planet?
Well, if there are bad ones, and I think that there are, I have not had to deal with them, thank goodness. The ones that I've dealt with and the abductees that I work with have all pretty much said the same thing, and that's that I think we're supposed to work with them. I would not take away that experience as far as I'm concerned. What's happened to me, don't stop it, because I think we need to continue to do what we're doing. They're trying to help us in their odd way. I think that we're supposed to cooperate with them in some manner as far as care of our planet, care of ourselves, which we don't do. And I think they're trying to perhaps help us health-wise, and take care of the earth, teach us to do that, and in turn change their bodies and their emotional outlook and all of it combined. I think that's what they're doing. I don't think there's anything bad about it.
That's good. Well, I have really enjoyed talking with both of you women, and now I'm going to turn it over to my co-host, Arielle, and she has a switchboard, and people, if they want to call in, they need to press 1 on their keypads so that you can talk to these wonderful ladies. So it's been my pleasure talking to both of you. Now to you, Arielle.
Okay, well, we will have some callers. We've got a few that are already calling in with questions. But, Kathleen, I wanted to ask you, I've always heard reference to Betty and Barney Hill and that being like the first really documented abduction case, but I think there's a lot of people that maybe have not heard of that. So could you please describe that a little?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Betty and Barney were a biracial New Hampshire couple in 1961. She was a social worker for the state of New Hampshire. He worked for the post office. Both were active in the civil rights movement and in politics in the state of New Hampshire. And Betty had a short vacation, and Barney decided to surprise her with a trip to Niagara Falls and on to Montreal. It was September of 1961. And when they were in Montreal, heard that there was a hurricane coming up the coast and decided that they should drive on home and anticipated that they'd arrive at about 2 o'clock in the morning. So as they were driving through the night, and they're in the state of New Hampshire now, upstate New Hampshire, Betty spotted a new light in the sky. And what caught her attention was that it appeared to travel upward very, very rapidly, rather than behaving like a typical falling star. And as she watched it, it grew larger and larger in the sky. And after that, she had been watching it for maybe 20 minutes, she asked Barney to stop so that she could get a closer look at this thing, because it was apparently unconventional. She had no interest in UFOs up to that point. She'd never read a book about it, didn't know much about it at all. I mean, everybody had heard of flying saucers back then. There was a little bit of information in the media about it. So Barney stopped the car, and they got out with binoculars and looked at this craft as it traveled away from them and then came back very, very rapidly. And they got back into the car. They realized that it was large and it was silent and they could see windows in it. And as they drove south, it traveled along, pacing their vehicle. When they arrived at an area called Franconia Notch, a beautiful scenic area in New Hampshire, cut through the mountains, they saw straight ahead Cannon Mountain. And that is a ski area, and there is a building at the top, and there's also a signal tower with a light on it. And when the craft passed over the signal tower, the light blinked out. It was a steady burning light, and that would indicate electromagnetic interference, we know today. They didn't know that back then. They decided to stop and take another look. So they stopped at the base of the Old Man of the Mountain. That was New Hampshire's state symbol. It fell off the mountain in 2003. But it was a granite profile of what looked like a man's face. It was 48 feet from forehead to chin. And Betty and Barney looked up at this craft as it hovered beside the old man's profile and could see that it was at least 1.5 times the length of the profile. They later said that it was about 80 feet in diameter. As they were looking at it, it appeared to be rotating, and it appeared to be lighted on only one side. It started moving in a stair-step pattern, and then it started bouncing back and forth in the sky. They got back into the car, headed south through Franconia Notch, and exited the notch at an area called Indian Head. And this is where the motels began, and there was a little tourist attraction there at that time as well. And Betty was becoming very excited as Barney's driving along watching the road. The craft is coming in closer and closer, and she wants him to stop and pull over to the side of the road for another look at this thing in the sky. And before he could, the craft stopped right over the road, right in front of them, and descended to within between 100 and 200 feet above their car. Barney had to stop the car dead in the middle of the road, straddling the center line, and he opened the door, stepped out with his binoculars, and looked up at this huge pancake that he saw in the sky. He and Betty could both see a lighted row of windows on this circular craft with a blue-white light shining from the windows. As Barney looked up at it, it moved again towards a farmer's field where there were a few little apple trees and a farm stand, and he followed it into the field. And as he looked up at it now, he could see 8 to 11 figures looking back at him. They were dressed in black, shiny uniforms, and he stated that they were somehow not human. This was part of his conscious continuous recall. At once, all but one of them moved away from this window towards a panel on the back of the corridor that encircled the craft. And Barney could see these figures' arms going up. He could see them from the tops of their heads down to their knees. And when they did this, something started to drop out of the bottom of the craft, and Barney became frightened. He thought that he was going to be captured like, quote, a bug in a net, close quote. And the individual that he called the leader held a special attraction for him and was telling him just to stay where he was and to keep looking. No harm would come to him. He was receiving this message apparently telepathically. Barney at that time wasn't sure how he knew this was happening. He certainly couldn't hear the leader say this to him. He ran back to the car as quickly as he could, breaking away, and as he did, the craft once again changed position to over the top of the car. Barney went speeding down the highway and told Betty to roll her window down and look up to see if she could see the craft overhead. And she did. She was expecting to see the lights on the craft. She didn't see the lights. She didn't see the sky. There was a waxing gibbous moon that night. It was almost full, but she couldn't see anything. All she could see was blackness. And then suddenly, she and Barney heard what sounded like beeping sounds or buzzing sounds striking the trunk of their vehicle. They were kind of electronic sounds. And they seemed to beep in a code or buzz in a code. Beep, 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 beep. Betty wished that she knew the Morse code because she was wondering if they were sending her a message, but she didn't. When this happened, a tingling sensation passed through Betty's and Barney's bodies, and the vibration passed through the car. And the next thing they knew, they were 30 to 35 miles down the highway. They had almost no memory of what had happened in the interim, except that they had somewhere along the way observed a fiery orb. They knew that it was moving, but they weren't moving. They had observed a roadblock somewhere along the way. They, again, didn't know where that occurred. They heard a second series of these buzzing sounds that brought them back to full consciousness, and they were seeking human contact. They felt the need to interact with other humans. They couldn't find anyone on the way home. And finally, they arrived at their home in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And it was then nearly 5 o'clock in the morning. They, anticipating arriving at about 2, it was now 5 a.m. There were marks on the trunk of their car, shiny spots that caused a compass needle to spin and spin, indicating a strong magnetic field in the area where they heard the buzzing sound. Betty's new dress, her favorite dress, was torn in several locations. There was a 2-inch tear at the top of the zipper, a 1-inch tear in the thick lip of fabric. The dress was torn from waist to hemline. The hem was torn down on one side. The tops of the shoes that Barney was wearing had been in perfect condition. He was a meticulous dresser. Yet they were scraped so badly that he had to buy new shoes. It was a really difficult time for them. And they had to put all of this together in their minds to try to figure out what had occurred. And the binocular strap was broken. They had some serious thinking to do and a lot of curiosity about what had happened to them. It was 2 years later before they were able to find a psychiatrist who used hypnosis who could see them. And Barney had been having difficulties with post-traumatic stress disorder, difficulty with ulcers. He developed bleeding ulcers, and so that is why they were referred to Dr. Simon. He was a prominent psychiatrist. He had had a great deal of success in working with soldiers who were returning from the war front during World War II, and Dr. Simon hypnotized them separately. for a period of 6 months, imposed amnesia at the end of each session, and toward the end of the hypnosis session, he let them begin to remember what had occurred. And I was 13 years old at the time. I saw all of this unfolding. I saw all of the evidence, including the spots on the car, and Betty's dress that developed a powdery substance on it that degraded the fiber of the dress. It's been examined in laboratories with anomalous findings. And even today, we don't know what that powder, that powdery substance is. We do know that Betty and Barney were taken separately onto a craft, a landed craft. The roadblock that they recalled was indeed extraterrestrial beings, and they were taken into separate examining rooms. Betty's dress was torn in the process. Barney's shoes were scraped in the process. They were given physical examinations. The ETs were very interested in their skeletal structure. They examined their hands, their feet, their extremities, their spinal column. They looked into all of the openings in their body, in their ears, their mouth, their nose. They were very interested that Betty had teeth and Barney's teeth were removable. And they did, yeah, a lot of people thought that was quite hilarious. And also, they took an ova sample from Betty through a needle in her navel and semen from Barney through a cup-like device placed over his groin. Betty was shown a star map that was later identified, and there's been a lot of controversy about that. And she was also shown alien symbols. And those symbols she drew in the year 2000 from memory for me, they remained in a locked file for many years until Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience was published in the year 2007. And I placed those files, the symbols in the back of the book, in the appendix of the book. And Don Dondry, who was a professor at McGill University, saw them, and he compared them to symbols that were drawn by experiences that he had done a study on in the year 2004 with Bud Hopkins and Stuart Appel from the State University of New York in Brockport. The amazing thing was that Betty's symbols were nearly identical to the symbols that Bud Hopkins had been collecting since 1975. And had been kept in his own locked files.
Wow.
It's quite a story, and with a lot of evidence.
Well, there's been a lot of publicity, press, and mentioned by others that researchers that we've had on the show, and they always seem to refer to Betty and Barney Hill as the prototype abduction case, because was it not the first acknowledged and well substantiated with the evidence you mentioned? Was it really
is absolutely true. It was the first alien abduction to stir worldwide interest. And, you know, it was released through a violation of confidentiality. It was never supposed to be released to the public because by that time, Barney had been appointed by the governor of the state of New Hampshire to serve on the U.S. Civil Rights Commission's State Advisory Committee. He was the chairman of the board of directors for the Rockingham County Community Action Program. He and Betty were very active in the state of New Hampshire in politics. To have this story of alien abduction come out, you can imagine, would have been extremely shocking to any of the people in the state of New Hampshire who knew them and held them in high esteem. So it really did stir a lot of attention when it came out. But those who knew Betty and Barney realized that they were credible people and believed their story. But unfortunately, there were others who didn't know Betty and Barney, who had an anti-UFO agenda who disseminated a lot of false and misleading information about them over the years.
And when we think about the time frame, you know, in the 60s, we were just thinking about going to the moon. So, I mean, it was really more in the realm of science fiction than it is today.
Yes. Yes, and you know, Betty, and I think that when did we land on the moon? Wasn't it 1968?
July
69.
69. It was 1969. And, you know, Barney passed away on February 25th, 1969, at the age of 46, and was never able to see that. Unfortunately. It was something that he and my grandfather always talked about and hoped to see someday, but they had both passed, my grandfather in 68 and Barney in 69.
Wow. Yeah. Something you always wish you could say. I remember because I was sitting in a hospital bed and all the doctors were standing around watching. It was July of 1969.
That's right, July 20th.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah. You know, I was wondering, Kathleen, while you were originally talking when you first came on, that if there was a connection between Betty and Barney's experience, because it seems that a lot of times they will work with bloodlines, and with Betty being your aunt, they would have known about you. You know what I mean?
Yes, they definitely would have. And I have to tell you that when Betty did a psychophysics experiments, and I wrote about this in Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO experience. Betty started doing psychophysics experiments with a team of scientists headed up by C.D. Jackson and Robert Holman, and this was after the hypnosis ended, I should say. And she was attempting to vector in a UFO. And the scientific team would give her a certain script that she was to read over and over again to try to send the message to the ETs. And then the team would go out and see if they could see a UFO in that particular location. Well, one of the places that she attempted to vector craft into was my grandparents' farm. And lo and behold, a craft actually did land on the farm. It was seen by a commercial pilot who lived on our street, who was returning home from work that night. It woke my grandparents up, and they looked out the window and saw it. I grew up across the street from my grandparents, and it woke up my younger brother as well. It left physical trace evidence on the ground. Sheared off the tops of some trees, and those trees ended up dying. Nothing would grow in that area for many, many years. But what I'm getting to is we started to have paranormal activity in our home after Betty started doing her experiments. And we had never had this kind of paranormal activity before that. We had light orbs in the house, we had poltergeist-type activity, and I found out that this occurs in about 88% of the homes of experiencers. And so I'm wondering if I started to be taken during that time frame. I don't know for sure that I was, but there's a lot of coincidences going on here, and I would like to know more about it. I think that maybe I'm going to ask Denise to do some hypnosis sessions with me.
Yes, I think that's something that we're both curious about. And another thing that we're trying to look into is we're finding that are people all of a sudden coming together as far as something that has occurred where they are realizing they've either seen each other on crafts, they've had experiences maybe years ago where they've seen a craft together and not realized it, and Kathy and I have possibly seen the same craft on the same day in the same afternoon and didn't realize it until many years later, when we were sitting having lunch and discussing that we both lived in separate towns, but way up in the mountains in the middle of nowhere. Why should we both live in places like that? And I talked about a craft that we saw in broad daylight, where we were, the year, the month, and she all of a sudden said, "Where did you live?" And we had just met, and we started to talk about it and explain it, and she said, "Well, you know, I was teaching school in a little town just down the road from you, and I saw a craft that same afternoon right across the foothills from you." So all these years later, we find out that happened. So are people coming together and finding out that they really do have a connection of some kind?
It's amazing, such a coincidence that we lived only 30 miles away from each other in Colorado. She was in Gunnison, I was in Crested Butte. So pretty amazing that we might have seen the same UFO on the same day and didn't know each other at the time, but lived 30 miles apart. And then we met years later in Florida.
Wow. And Florida is where I had my first sighting, and on the west coast of Florida, and there was like a whole fleet of maybe like 10 or 12, and they
were
just this choreographed kind of dance in the sky. I mean, it was clearly extraterrestrial. And, I mean, I was with a group of people, and we were all standing out in the front yard just watching it out over the water. And it was just like an exhibition or something. You know how the, what are those pilot Thunderbirds? You know,
mm-hmm.
they do all that formation flying. Well, this was like, you know, go really fast and then do a right angle turn at the same speed kind of demonstration. But I had a sense of wonderment, and I didn't feel any fear because they were pretty far away, but I know Florida's got a lot of activity.
They can have spells of it, hot spots, and
yeah, that's true. But when I was there, it was in the 80s, especially in the mid 80s, and there was a lot of activity at that time. But Denise, I wanted to ask you about when you do work with people to try to help them in remembering. Is this something that you do only in person?
No, I'll speak with people on the phone and try to work through what has happened with them. We try to discover first, did they have an actual experience? We go through the steps and try to work out some of their anxiety. I always feel a connection with a person who's gone through this turmoil, and if they have some post-traumatic stress, and what are they looking for? I always ask them, what do you need from me? Can I help you find a support group? Do you want to go and see a hypnotherapist to see what might happen there? You know, and work out their needs. Once they connect with me or call me or send me an email, I can't leave it alone. I need to have them go on the search with me and see what it is they need. And if they're close to me, and I've had people get on a plane and fly to me, then I'm going to see them. If they're going to go to that trouble and they need help to that degree, then I'm going to see them and see what I can do.
Well, just for the record, it would, if they went to your website, if someone felt like the connection that you, like they wanted to speak with you, can they find that contact information on your website?
Absolutely, yes. It's Denise, M as in Margaret, Stoner.com.
Okay, great.
Now, what I'm going to ask them to do first is go to where it says questionnaire, fill that questionnaire out for me. Even if they don't have a response to all of it, make an attempt. It will help them also. Fill that out and send it to me, and then we go from there, because that's something that Kathleen and I are both working on. We want to see what has happened to people. And it won't take them very long. Just follow the directions, fill that out, and send it to me.
Okay. All right. Well, we have a caller with a question, and we are going to bring him online right now as soon as I get the microphone open. Hello, Ralph. You are on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call on this very exciting show. As usual, I have some very great guests. And Kathleen, I had a question about the intent that you may have discovered. Is there a common intent? I know you mentioned that the ones that you have discovered had not been quote-unquote bad, but or nefarious, but I was wondering if the, you know, if you considered the fact that they would go against the will of the people that were abducted as being sort of, you know, kind of bad intent for those who had to go through these experiences.
Well, yes, I think that a lot of this is a matter of human perception, and certainly some people will perceive the ETs, even if they mean no harm, as intruding into their private space, committing criminal acts against them by kidnapping them, by forcing them to undergo medical procedures against their will. And so those people would perceive the ETs as being negative or unkind, whereas others would have a different perspective of that. And they would think that, well, this is what we would probably do if we went to another planet and we discovered intelligent life and we wanted to know more about the people on that planet. In fact, it's part of a plan that we developed for our space program way back in the 50s, that if we found intelligent life, we would abduct those people and study them. So, you know, we would probably do the same thing. So I really think that it's a matter of perspective. Now, of course, some people do report very negative experiences overall, such as rape. And certainly none of us would ever consider that to be acceptable.
Okay, that's an interesting perspective. But I was also wondering, if, with all your experience with different abductees, have you ever considered that maybe there was some connection between those who did the abductions and maybe some group or people here on our planet, humans, that were working in tandem with these folks?
That the humans would do what?
No, if you had thought that maybe they had some similar agenda or working together with maybe folks in either the government or some other societies to accomplish whatever mission they were trying to do. In other words, were they working in cahoots?
So you're talking about what so many people call MILAB or MILAB abductions, military abductions that are military people who are working in concert with ETs and abducting humans. And there is a percentage of individuals who do report seeing this. There's a little bit of controversy about whether or not these are actually American military people doing this through some kind of a black ops project, or if they are actually hybrid beings that have been bred and born to the ETs on their craft using human genetic material and then are dressed in military uniform. A lot of this appears to be going on in underground bases, but there is some indication that the ETs might be living here underground and certainly under the water, so that they probably won't have to travel in and out of our atmosphere and risk being shot at. Plus, they can use our resources when they're here. And those are just some of my thoughts.
Hmm. Okay, my last question is, have you heard that any of the abductees have had physical or etheric implants?
Yes, absolutely. A large percentage of the experiencers who participated in our commonality study stated that they could feel implants in their bodies. In fact, Denise actually had one in her arm, and I was able to feel that. It was maybe a little bit smaller than a BB, and I watched it, and she watched it over about a one-week period. She was even thinking about having it x-rayed, but before it could, it went into her hand and just disappeared. And one other experiencer that I work with, she is up in Maine, had the same kind of thing happen and sent me a photograph. I was down in Florida at the time, but sent me a photograph of the what she thought was an implant moving down her arm as well. And Dr. Roger Lear has done a lot of work on this, and Steve Colburn. So if you're not familiar with them, you can look them up on the Internet. Steve is a material scientist, and he has been analyzing the implants that Dr. Lear has removed from experiencers, and they have highly unusual properties. The human body will not reject them. They're coated with some kind of a substance. They appear to attach to nerve endings, and they're very difficult to get out. When the surgeon tries to remove the implants, he'll make an incision and go in, and the implant will actually move away as the surgeon is attempting to remove it. They appear to be made out of nanotubes and nanocrystals, far more advanced than anything that we're capable of making. And there, Steve Colburn has found meteoric material and rare earth minerals in the implants that Dr. Lear has removed. Quite interesting.
Yeah, it is very interesting. Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's a very fascinating subject here.
You're welcome.
Have a good night.
You too.
Thanks for calling, Ralph. Bye-bye. Well, you know, the work that Lavendar has done over the years does answer the one question that Ralph was asking about the intent. And certainly everything that you've been talking about demonstrates that there are two kinds of abductions, you know, the kind that you signed up for and the one that where you're just minding your own business and you just seem to get targeted, and who, you know, all the levels of interaction, whether it's between the government and the military and the ETs and between different ET races and all that, there is, from the work that we've done, and I'm just kind of trying to sum this all up here, that there is intent for assistance in our global, our planet's evolution, our spiritual evolution, our ascension of consciousness, and a lot of the work that's being done by the members of ET races that do respect the universal laws and they have a code of ethics and all. It is for the planetary ascension. And I think, Kathleen, it was you that said that, you know, ETs, like they were there, sometimes they just fly by and they look, it's like, oh, look, there's intelligent life, let's go check it out. And that certainly may be the case sometimes, but there are definitely certain races who have been here for, I mean, eons, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years, and as colonizing. So, and that's kind of where the starseed bloodlines enter into the picture. So I just kind of wanted to put interject that in because there are many, many millions of people, starseed bloodlines, who did agree to come. And a lot of time, I know that just in our experience with Lavendar and myself, the work that's being done at night is to support something that we're doing. Or, as you said, you know, supporting your health. So there's probably as many MOs as there are different races.
Probably, and some are kind and benevolent, and just as we humans have some good and some bad, I think that they probably do as well. But I think that I agree with you that in the long run, from all of the information that I've been able to compile, I think that they are helping to move humans forward. You call it ascension, many people do. In my opinion, that ascension is to move us ahead to so that we will become closer to them. In that
right.
We will develop telepathic abilities, that we'll develop a collective consciousness, that we'll lose some of this primitive and negative behavior that we have.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I mean, the word ascension, I'm just talking about the gradual raising of consciousness and awareness as people become more socially conscious, environmentally conscious, the unity consciousness, all of that is part of this graduation, if you will. And
mm-hmm.
ultimately, the world peace is one of the main benefits. Not blowing up our planet would be another one. So, and they do care for the good of this planet and the people, for the majority. But it does seem that the more unpleasant cases tend to get a lot more publicity.
Yeah,
especially when Hollywood
gets,
when Hollywood gets into it, then look out.
Absolutely, you know. I guess that's what sells.
Well, right. And unfortunately, at this point in time, people don't. They're not quite so interested in upliftment as they are in shock. So, but we're still. I mean, we're gradually moving through these changes, and I fully know. It's not a belief. As I fully know that they, the vast majority are here for our empowerment, our enlightenment, and to keep us from extinguishing ourselves. As has happened in the past.
Yes.
So, once again, Kathleen, your website is Kathleen, Kathleen-Marden, M-A-R-D, like David, E-N.com. And Denise, your website is Denise, M, like Margaret Stoner, S-T-O-N-E-R.com. And you have quite a few services. I would encourage our listeners to check out your websites, and certainly if you have, if you're struggling with a abduction aftermath or trying to find understanding, you might be able to help some people that would contact you. And the books on your website, Kathleen, the Alien Abduction Files, Captured, there were a couple others that I saw.
Yes, Science Was Wrong was one of them. And
Science,
UFOs and Aliens.
Well, I'm sure they are all worthwhile reading, and would encourage everyone to just take a visit to your websites. And I do want to thank you both. Kathleen, I know you have to go do another radio show here, so we're going to wrap it up. And thank you so much for spending this evening with us. And thank you for the work that you do and for the people that whose lives you are making a difference in. and keep it up.
Thank you for having us on the show. It was a pleasure to be on.
Yes, thank you very much.
It is my pleasure, too. And, Lavendar, if you have anything that you want to add before I sign off here, now would be the time.
Well, I just want to give you a huge bravo, bravo, bravo for being who you are and coming forward with this research and these stories, because it's going to help, you know, thousands and thousands of people. People are going to be waking up to all of this really quick, really fast, when we have mass ships come down and people are going to see them all at once. They're going to need to know where to go. They're going to be researching the people that have already had these experiences. So you've been pioneering it. So now get ready to get your boots on and your and your shields up, because here's part two of all of this, and I feel like it's going to be coming in the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I encourage those that are listening to the show to check out your websites and keep in touch with you ladies, because you'll probably be needing their assistance before you know it.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Kathleen Martin and Denise Stoner, for joining us. And we thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week, as we are every Tuesday at 7 Eastern Time. Thank you to Chris and Fiona for helping with the switchboard. And we will see you next week. Thanks so much, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Good night.
You've been listening to Starseed Radio Academy. Visit our website at www.starseedhotline.com.